The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 4, Illusions. Colin James made his slow way through the mass of people. The entire Standing Point team had just spent the last 2 hours out on the parade ground during a bitter November evening. They were now all crowded into various barracks and mess rooms, wrapped in blankets and drinking hot tea. The evacuation had gone relatively smoothly, thought James. Only a couple of twisted ankles on the arduous trek up the endless flights of steps out of the underground facility. The roll call had taken too long, but they had needed to verify the 2 missing persons. Apart from these, there had been only 14 minor injuries directly related to the explosion. A miracle, really, he thought. But all that had only been the start of James's troubles today. As the Maundsworth base commander, he was the focal point for seemingly endless streams of converging information. He seemed to have had at least one telephone pressed constantly to his ear for the past 2 hours. Coordinating the firefighters, trapped in the array's labyrinthine subsystem, whilst at the same time evacuating over 200 civilian personnel had been bad enough, but then it had just gotten whimsical. The first device the firefighters had discovered had been made safe quite quickly by the bomb disposal squad, when they had finally arrived. That was half an hour ago, and now they were saying that this device had led to another, and then another. So far they had found 3 huge caches of explosives, and it looked as if there were plenty more. In the meantime, James was getting reports from the civilian lab crew that 4 of the expedition team were trapped in the field. Not only that, one had returned dead in suspicious circumstances, with possible links to the Sally Ames murder. It seemed to be turning into a major incident. He rubbed his temples. His head ached badly. James pushed on through the crowd of people. Most looked pretty shaken up. Army medics picked between the hastily set up bunks, checking for any more injuries. James was a powerfully built man, a full head taller than most of the people around him. He was searching for somebody in the throng. Eventually he caught sight of a familiar head of tangled grey hair. Grace was sitting on the edge of a bed, wrapped in a navy blue blanket. She stared vacantly ahead as the medic examined her, first taking her pulse, then shining a torch into her eyes. James waited until the man had finished. "How is she?" he asked quietly, taking the medic to one side.
"She's pretty good, sir," replied the medic, whilst bagging up his equipment.
"She's in shock, but it's quite mild. She'll be all right after a good rest." "Thank you, orderly," whispered James, as he looked over in concern towards Grace. He had the feeling there wouldn't be much chance for rest in the next few hours. "Grace," he said warmly, sitting down on the edge of the bed next to her. She blinked for a moment, and then turned questioningly to Colin. She had a wild look in her eyes.
"Colin? Colin, what's going on? What's happening? We need to get back down. They're trapped. We need to..."
"It's okay, Grace," said James tenderly. "We're doing everything we can now. You just rest for a while. There is nothing you can do for..."
But Colin, they're stuck out there. And Patty, what's happened to Patty? No one knows what's going on. I can't find anything out."
Grace was shivering under her blanket.
"Look, wait here, Grace. I'll get you some tea," said Colin.
"Coffee, strong, 3 sugars," she smiled bleakly.
When he got back with 2 mugs of strong coffee, James thought Grace looked more composed than when he had left her. He sat down beside her again, and they both sipped their drinks in silence.
"So what's going on, Colin?" Grace whispered eventually.
Colin sighed. The telephone call which she had just received made it clear that no civilians should be cleared for information on today's events, but with Grace it was somehow different.
"This is strictly confidential," he said slowly.
"It was a bomb, Grace."
"A bomb?"
echoed Grace, in a tone of disbelief. "Or rather, one of a chain of explosives, rigged throughout a large part of the array that actually went off. We were lucky the whole place didn't go up."
"But who? I mean, why? What does anyone..."
began Grace, dumbfounded. Colin held up his hand to silence her. "We think this is a part of a coordinated attack on the whole Standing Point project,"
he said gravely.
You knew this was going to happen, didn't you?
Whispered Grace accusingly.
When I asked you about Patty's medical records, you rang back just afterwards and said there may be a terrorist threat. Did you know something about the bomb then?
Grace, I didn't know anything about the bomb, trust me.
But you said...
Grace, it was a hunch. I received some news and I just thought we should be careful. I'm not trying to deceive you, Grace.
Just tell me what's going on, Colin, sighed Grace wearily.
Okay, said James eventually. Shortly before you telephoned me to ask about Patty's medical records, well, I received a call from my superiors. I'm sorry, Grace, but it was to tell me that Keith Lambert was dead. He was assassinated in his hotel room a few hours ago.
Keith, she breathed, open-mouthed. He's dead. Oh my God, did you say assassinated? Do you think it was connected to the project?
We think it was because of the whole new scale of funding he was on the verge of securing for this project. His voice trailed off to a whisper.
I'm sorry, Grace. I know he was a good friend of yours.
James lay a huge, reassuring hand over Grace's.
This is all too much to take in, she said quietly.
She took out a battered cigarette from her pocket and looked at it for a second. She let it fall through her fingers to the floor.
So all of this is to stop the project? She whispered sadly.
I don't know, Grace. It's too early to tell. Like I said, I'm just playing a hunch, really. I might be completely wrong. None of it may be connected.
But someone felt the need to ring you up, to tell you Keith Lambert had been killed, said Grace.
Colin looked away from her hard stare. He could see that she knew there was so much he was holding back.
I just want to get my team back, said Grace.
Her voice was steady and resolved once again.
I know, Grace.
We're going to get you back down there as soon as it's safe. We'll get them back, don't worry.
I'm going to need damage reports, replacements for any injured personnel. Jim Grayson, you know, from Hyden Hill. Now I'll definitely need...
I've called in any personnel on holiday and replacements from Hyden, plus anyone who may be under threat because of their links to Standing Point. I've also set you up a temporary control room in the officer's mess. I put Baker and Alison Reese at your disposal. They can link up with me. Grace looked instantly animated.
Well, why didn't you say so earlier?
She snapped, standing up and throwing off her blanket. She stooped and picked up her fallen cigarette, tucking it behind her ear.
Let's go then. Jane, I'm going to need you and Morgan right away.
She stormed off through the throng of people, cursing and muttering.
Soon back to normal, thought James with a sigh.
He stood up wearily and followed her out of the hall.
Alex sat in the back of the taxi, cursing quietly to himself.
How could I have been so stupid? He whispered. What the hell was I thinking? I'm really in for it now.
He couldn't work out just why he had acted the way he did. The circumstances had been more than a little suspicious. But to leave the case, why didn't he just carry it off the plane with him? He had acted so out of character. It was years since he had panicked like that. He breathed deeply, trying to take stock and work out just how he could salvage the situation. He could go to Stansted Airport when he got off the coach and try to reclaim the case. That in itself was very risky. Customs were bound to have searched it.
Oh, this was a bad situation to be in. He cursed his stupidity again.
The other option was to try and contact Dragor, although it was likely he had left for a safe house straight after their meeting. Alex knew he would get a dressing down from Dragor either way, but he may have some useful advice or information.
Driver, change of plan. Could we stop off at Green Lane, please? Said Alex.
Come past there now, mate, grunted the driver dully.
Well, turn around then, he snarled.
Alex wasn't a big man, but he had a presence about him and could exude a certain ferocity when he needed to.
All right, keep your ear on, grumbled the driver. You're the one paying for your mistakes.
That's right, whispered Alex to himself.
He wondered what the price of this particular error would be.
Whereabouts, mate?
Asked the taxi driver as they pulled into Green Lane. Alex looked up from the note he was scribbling on the inside lid of his cigarette packet. Slow down. Keep driving straight down here, he said, peering out of the window at the run-down houses and shop fronts. Here, stop here, he called as they pulled up to a derelict semi-detached house. Wait for me. I'll only be a second, he said, as he dashed out of the car. Hey, wait, shouted the driver. But Alex had already disappeared down a narrow overgrown alley alongside the house. Shit, he cursed. You better come back, you miserable git. After a few seconds, Alex appeared out of the alley and jumped back in the car. Drive, please, he said, looking around anxiously. The Angel Hotel, Grove Street. You sure this time? Muttered the driver, miserably.
Can't go on any further. I just can't. I'm sorry.
O'Keefe sat crouched against a low rock, his arms wrapped around his knees.
Look, Dan, we had this out back in the cave, pleaded Davison. If we don't get those spare tanks, we're going to die. We don't know if that thing is still there or not. It's been over 4 hours.
Saul knelt next to O'Keefe. For all his words, he still couldn't help himself from glancing anxiously around for any sign of the creature. A deep, buried fear had been awakened by its presence.
I just can't do it, sobbed O'Keefe.
Davison glanced inquiringly up at Starling, who gave a hopeless shrug.
Look, Dan, said Saul desperately. The suits are failing. If we leave you here, we may not be able to find you on the way back. We can't afford to split up. I'm sorry. I can't, whispered O'Keefe despondently.
Davison gave a sigh and stood up.
Okay, Dan, it's all right. Just stay here and sit tight. Don't try and make it back to the cave on your own, understood? We'll get the air tanks, then we'll pick you up on the way back.
O'Keefe didn't acknowledge the three men as they trudged off through the howling gale, following Starling's ailing positioning system. Davison looked at his arms and hands as they walked. A thick crust of red corrosion caked his gauntlets. The paint covering the metal plates on his suit was blistered and chipped in the harsh environment. He pulled open the wrist panel to run his suit's diagnostics, and the metal case broke off in his hand. He crumbled it between his fingers, and it broke up into flakes of rust. He wondered how long his suit would remain intact, and tried not to ponder the integrity of the spare air tanks, which they were desperately searching for. Starling stopped and crouched down just ahead of them. Davison froze, staring hard into the dust cloud, trying to glimpse any sign of the nightmarish creature. He crept cautiously up to Starling's shoulder.
What is it? He whispered.
Suddenly, from out of the dust reared a huge black shadow. There was a loud crack like a whip, and Saul fell backwards with a shriek, his arms held up over his face. He caught a glimpse of the shadow speeding towards Starling, who crouched, paralysed with fear. The huge black shape struck him and engulfed him in an instant. Davison rolled and got to his knees, desperately crawling away, sobbing and coughing. His whole body shook with terror. He tried to blank out the shrieking he heard, blasting in his earpiece. But then he realised it was not screaming at all, but laughter.
It's the tent! It's the bloody tent!
He heard Starling call over and over again, laughing with relief. Davison stopped and crumpled to the earth. He looked around to see Starling and Nick struggling with a huge piece of tattered silver fabric. Starling was still sitting on the ground laughing softly to himself as the heavy material whipped about him in the gale. Saul rolled onto his side, gasping in relief.
The bloody tent, chuckled Starling to himself. Thanks for leaping to my assistance, Saul,
he giggled.
I'm sorry,
it's okay, said Starling, calming down.
I thought I was a goner there, though. Come on, let's get going.
Are we at the camp, then? Whispered Davison.
No, I think this piece of fabric just caught on some rocks. The camp should be about 50 meters ahead.
Starling's voice had taken on a nervous tone, as the reality of the situation sunk in once again. They staggered on slowly through the storm, barely able to see 10 feet in front of them. Soon dark shapes started to loom out of the red swirling dust. Jumbles of smashed boxes and equipment lay strewn across the rocks.
There goes the Atmos testing kit, I suppose, joked Nix bleakly, as they came upon the shattered remains of the apparatus. The tent with the canisters should be over there, I think.
They crept forward, ready to take flight at the first sign of the creature, but all they saw and heard was the howling of the storm. After a time, they discovered the site where the tent had stood. Now only a few fragments of material remained, whipping about in the gale. Amid the jumble of broken equipment, they found the stack of air canisters in surprisingly good condition.
Thank the Lord, breathed Starling. Dan? Dan, are you still there?
There was a burst of static in their ears.
Dan, are you still there? Asked Saul, looking in concern at the others. Yeah, I'm still here, came a faint voice, barely audible over the crackle. Great, Dan. Look, we've found all the tanks. They're all intact. We'll be back soon, Davison reassured him as they started the process of swapping their canisters over.
I can hear things out in the storm, whispered O'Keefe faintly.
You just hang in there, Dan, said Davison.
Come on, hurry it up, hurry it up, he whispered to himself as he screwed the valves on the heavy canister, all the while glancing nervously around.
Keep talking to us, Dan, he said, trying to sound confident.
I can hear them. I can hear them, O'Keefe sobbed quietly.
You'll be all right, Dan, do you hear? We're coming back now, okay? We're on our way.
Hurry,
came back the whispered plea from O'Keefe. Soon they were trudging back as fast as they could towards O'Keefe, struggling under the weight of the two spare tanks, Dan's and Patty's. Davison stumbled along between Nix and Starling. The three carried the two tanks between them, and in his spare hand Nix carried a short sample axe which he'd found in the wreckage. He glanced nervously from side to side, the weapon held up in front of him. He looked far too strung out, thought Saul.
Dan, how are you doing?
He asked once again over the comlink. After a few more calls, a weak voice came back.
Okay, I guess. I can see their shadows in the storm. I can hear them.
The three gave each other anxious glances.
You just hang in there, Dan. We're nearly there, okay? Said Davison.
Okay,
whimpered O'Keefe.
Gary, how far away are we? Whispered Davison breathlessly.
They stopped, and Starling studied the panel on his wrist, wiping away the dust and corrosion. He banged it a couple of times.
Nearly there, he gasped. Over to the left a bit, about 100 meters.
When they finally came upon O'Keefe, he was in the same position as they had left him. They swapped his tank over for him, then led him back up the short gully.
I could hear them,
he whispered as they walked. Another quarter of an hour, and they were sitting exhausted in the comparative peace of the small cave.
Okay, gasped Saul, stretching his aching legs.
Now we can wait for the rescue team. Nobody said a word or looked at him. They had not heard anything from control for almost 7 hours now. They all knew something must have gone badly wrong back at home.
Alex sat, looking somberly into his untouched pint of beer. It was coming up to 10 o'clock, the time he'd set for Drago Milovich to contact him. If Drago didn't ring, then Alex wasn't quite sure what his next move would be. He supposed he would just have to risk getting the case back from lost luggage at Stansted, assuming some overzealous policeman hadn't had it blown up. The plane would have landed about an hour ago, and Alex was stuck in a miserable pub, waiting for a call from someone who probably hadn't even got his message. He would have a lot of explaining to do. The shrill of the payphone burst across the silent room. Alex jumped and pretended to ignore it. Was it Drago? The phone rang and rang. The lugubrious barmaid looked up from her magazine with a pained expression, then went back to her horoscopes.
Pick up the phone,
thought Alex anxiously to himself, willing the morose girl into action. The harsh ring continued until eventually the barmaid gave a curse and shuffled away across the bar.
Angel Hotel, she sighed apathetically into the receiver.
Hold on, I'll check. Green? Are you called Green? She called to Alex across the empty room. Alex put on his best surprise face, looking up from his flat beer.
Green? Why, yes, that's me, he stuttered.
Phone, said the girl flatly, dropping the receiver onto the wet bar and shuffling back to her seat and her magazine. Alex walked over to the phone and picked up the handset, turning his back to the girl who eyed him suspiciously.
Hello,
he murmured.
Alexei, is that you?
Came Drago's voice.
Drago, thank heavens you haven't left town. Look, I've got some bad news. I need your help. I went and did something really stupid today. Just bottled out on the plane.
Thank God you're alive,
burst in Drago.
I thought I was the only one left. What are you still doing in town? It isn't safe.
Hey, Drago, my friend, hold on. Alex had never heard Milovic panicked before, but now he was babbling madly.
What's going on?
He cast a glance at the barmaid, who quickly went back to looking at her magazine.
What do you mean? Haven't you seen? The plane, it's all over the news. We were set up, Alexei. Damn well set up from the start. Just get out of there, if they find out you're still alive.
Alex was floundering. He didn't know what to think. He needed more information. His head was aching with the strain.
Look, slow down, my friend. What's going on? What plane are you talking about?
He asked his question slowly, not knowing if he wanted to hear the answer.
The flight you were meant to be on today crashed about 5 minutes after takeoff. As soon as I found out, I decided to get out. I checked the drop points in order to contact the others, but there was nothing, Alexei. Only your message. Then I heard about Victor. We've been set up, my friend. They'll be after me now. I know it.
Calm down. What happened to Victor? He whispered. Drago was getting more hysterical.
A car crash this morning. He's dead, Alexei.
Alex tried hard to work it out.
Who would be setting them up? It made no sense.
Look, we've got to meet up, he said at last. Remember the place from the Beringer job?
Get there as soon as you can. We'll sort it out. Don't worry.
Beringer? That was years ago. Do you think it will still be intact?
Asked Drago in a high-pitched tone. I don't know. But it's not connected with all of this, that's all. I'll be there in about 2 hours, okay? Said Alex, looking at his watch.
2 hours, okay,
said Drago nervously.
Be careful, Alexei.
Good luck, my friend, whispered Alex and put the phone down. He turned around to see the barmaid staring mistrustfully at him. Wrong number, said Alex brightly, and walked out of the pub. Grace put down the telephone receiver and gave a sigh of relief.
Ah, okay, at last,
she whispered.
Good news?
Asked Jane Honeyman.
They've got all the major systems areas cleared,
said Grace, hurriedly stuffing papers into her bag.
We can go back down.
Oh, at last, said Jane, as she too started to gather her belongings together.
Is there any news on the damage to the array?
It all seems to be confined to Section B of the subsystem. I think we may be able to reroute and miss it out altogether, said Grace, hopefully.
I'll just be glad to get out of this cupboard.
The past 4 hours had been spent in their makeshift control room in the officers' mess. They were cramped, hot and tired, as well as frustrated at not being able to get back to the array. James was seeing to the replacement personnel problems and was off somewhere organising workers. This hadn't left much for Grace and her team to do, except watch the clock and worry for the lives of their trapped friends.
Alison, called Grace across the bustling room. Have you heard from Colin yet, about getting hold of Jim Grayson?
Alison Rees, a short, officious staff sergeant, looked up from the papers she was studying. She cupped her hand over the telephone receiver she held.
Commander James is still unavailable. He is at present liaising with the emergency services, attempting to ascertain. Just tell him to get Jim in pronto. I'll be down in array control when he gets back,
called Grace, as she headed for the door, a line of technicians behind her.
Dr. Palmer, wait! You cannot go down there until I receive authorization from...
called Alison. But Grace was already out of the room.
How? She cursed. Baker, follow them down, and make sure they stay in the safe areas. That Palmer's a law unto herself.
Pat Baker grabbed his jacket and hurried after Grace and her team. Grace had walked halfway across the parade ground when James's car pulled up alongside them. He sprang out and ran to catch up with Grace, who had ignored his arrival.
"Grace, Grace, just where do you think you're going?" demanded James, striding along beside her.
Grace stared straight ahead, with her jaw set and a determined look in her eye.
"Where do you think I'm going, Colin?" she snapped. "I'm trying to rescue my colleagues." "I told Allison that nobody was to re-enter the array without my permission. Where in hell is she?"
He looked around and caught sight of Baker hurrying after them, a worried look on his face.
"Grace, it's not safe to go in there yet," he said, taking her arm and pulling her to a halt.
She snatched her arm away.
"Emergency teams have just informed me that all major system sites are clear. We can get back to work whilst your men clean up the rest of the array."
Jane Honeyman, standing at Grace's side, looked surprised at this news.
"Do you mean there still might be a bomb down there?" she asked.
James pulled Grace to one side, making sure he was out of earshot from the others.
"Grace, I told you about those things in confidence. Just who have you been talking to? You must wait until it is safe down there," he said in exasperation. "Jane has a right to know what's going on here," said Grace indignantly. "She's my deputy, and if anything happens to me, she'll be expected to take over right away. Now, I've got to get Saul and the others back whilst there is still a chance. I will not leave them out there to die."
She stared hard at Colin, with her hands on her hips.
"Yes, yes," sighed Colin eventually.
"But you're to stay strictly in the safe areas. I'm sending a security team in with you to make sure of that."
Grace smiled in relief, then turned and headed for the facility entrance.
"What about Jim Grayson?" she called over her shoulder.
"Oh, we're having trouble locating him, but we'll get him here soon," he shouted after her.
"And I've got someone else on the way, who may be of real assistance too," he called.
"I don't care, Colin, just get me Jim Grayson ASAP," shouted Grace. Then she was gone.
"Well, thanks for your help, Colin," snapped James to himself. "That woman is going to drive me insane," he shouted across the empty parade ground.
He stormed back to his car and got in, slamming the door behind him. He looked at the reflection of his driver's eyes, studying him in the rearview mirror.
"Drive,"
he barked, and settled angrily back into his seat. Alex stumbled down the street in a daze. He had just come out of the internet cafe, where he had spent the past quarter of an hour looking at images of the crash site of the East Midlands flight to Stansted. There could be a chance it was an accident, he thought for a second, then discarded it. Somebody had wanted Alex dead, and they were prepared to kill a plane full of people to do it. Alex tried hard to calm his manic train of thought as he wandered aimlessly along the busy street. He barely noticed as he bumped into someone.
"Which way are you going, idiot?" snapped the man, then was gone.
Whoever wanted him dead must have believed he was on the plane. Otherwise they'd be after him now, he thought. He looked around anxiously. It was dark now, and his head was aching even more. He stopped on a bustling street corner, not knowing what to do next. He didn't even know whether he could trust Dragor or not. He had known him for almost 15 years. He had to trust him. But could it be true that all the others were gone? Victor, at least, was a definite. His car was found at the bottom of a railway embankment this afternoon. He was snatched away from his reverie by the sound of shouting nearby. Looking up, he saw a young couple arguing on the other side of the street. A girl was screaming abuse at an obviously drunken man. She would walk a few steps away from him, then turn and yell a few more insults, repeating this procedure down the street as he followed her, swearing loudly. Alex watched as a man caught up with the girl, all the while yelling at her. The man grabbed her shoulder and span her around, whereupon she slapped him across the face and spat at him. The drunken man, enraged, pulled his arm back to strike her. Alex's eye was drawn by a faint movement behind and to the left of the man. A shadow seemed to flit around him, striking in a rapid motion. Alex turned away quickly, shaking his head. Looking back, he made out a faint, sickly glow around the couple, who were now arguing face to face. A vague outline of a claw, insect-like, suggested itself to Alex's eye.
It lashed across the face of the man, who carried on oblivious to it. Alex held his throbbing temples and squeezed his eyes shut.
No, not yet, not yet, he cursed to himself.
The shouting had stopped, and Alex opened his eyes again. The girl was walking off angrily, and the man was leaning against a wall, muttering to himself. There was nothing otherwise out of the ordinary to be seen. He gazed nervously around. Everything seemed as normal.
Please, not yet, he whispered to himself.
You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.